Matthew 24, verses 1 through 35. Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." And as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of the birth pains. And then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations. And then the end will come. So when you see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by the prophet Daniel, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in the house. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas for women who are pregnant, and for those days who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be great tribulation, such as not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, 'Look, he is in the wilderness,' do not go out. If they say, 'Look, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. And from the fig tree learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near, at the very gates. And truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." The word of the Lord. There is a bit of confusion as to the times and fulfillments of the last days as given by Jesus. In lamenting this problem, pastor and author Sam Storm shares a 2010 advertisement, one reflecting and spreading such confusion. The advertisement is seemingly ubiquitous. It has appeared in virtually every daily newspaper of every major city in the U.S. I most recently saw it in the sports section of USA Today. It is, if nothing else, bold and unequivocal in its prediction that Christ is coming very soon. The article proceeds to identify 8 compelling reasons why this is true. He explains, in 5 out of the 8 compelling reasons, Matthew 24 and the Olivet Discourse of Jesus figure prominently. For example, the increase of famines, violence, and wars is allegedly a sign that the return of Christ is near, citing Matthew 24, 6 through 8. The increase in earthquakes is also cited as an indication that the end is near, citing Matthew 24, 7. The explosion of cults and counterfeit spirituality, Matthew 24, 24, as well as the deceptive activity of the Antichrist, Matthew 24, 15, are all cited as infallible signs of the impending second coming. And we've all seen such things. There always seems to be someone pointing to this or that sign, saying that Jesus is coming soon because of it. The problem, however, is that Jesus did not speak of these things as signs to point to his second coming, his parousia, at the end of time. Rather, they refer to things that occurred long ago, particularly from AD 33, culminating in the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And the sermons for today and next week are intended to provide essentially a sketch of the vital aspects of Jesus' prophecies as given in the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 concerning what was to come and what is yet to come. And I had meant to preach this whole discourse in one sermon, but due to time considerations, it seemed best to divide it into two. And also note that Jesus' discourse is recorded in Mark chapter 13 and Luke 21 with some variations. And my hope is that a rundown of this discourse, that this rundown will provide the benefit of a basic biblical understanding of Jesus' prophecy, arming you against false pronouncements and advertisements that basically say that Jesus is coming again soon because of these signs. You know, so there's that, but there's also the more direct purpose, which I've talked for, I guess, a month or so now about, that for this rundown, I want to prepare you and I, both of us, all of us, for this journey that we're going to undertake through the apocalypse of John, Revelation, which we will begin, Lord willing, the first week of February. Notice I said, Lord willing, the first week of February there. So it was going to be next week, but it moved. It's all the Lord's timing, right? So, why is it important to start a study in Revelation with the Olivet Discourse? Well, to put it simply, if we have an understanding of the framework of Jesus' Olivet Discourse, then we have a framework for understanding Revelation. And this is because in many notable ways, Revelation is John's Olivet Discourse. His is the only gospel that does not include the discourse. And while his apocalypse was revealed to him at a later time than Olivet, the parallels are significant. And my premise to you is that the discourse provides a key to understanding the book of Revelation. And with that key in mind, we can approach our study of Revelation with confidence that the book will open to us in a way we can understand. Now, dispelling confusion here will help clear up much confusion as we embark on that journey. In the Olivet Discourse, in Matthew 24 through 25, it was given on the heels of the dramatic events that happened at the temple in the preceding chapters. And towards the end of Jesus' visit there in Matthew 23, Jesus gave a scathing denunciation of the Jewish religious leaders. And immediately prior to our passage today, in chapter 23, verse 35, Jesus told them that judgment was coming down upon them for all the righteous blood shed on the earth. And then he tells them when, in verse 36, truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. Judgment was coming soon. And Jesus then laments over Jerusalem in verse 38, saying, see, your house is left to you desolate, referring to the temple. And illustrating his point, Jesus then departs the temple in Matthew 24, 1, heading to the Mount of Olives. And his movements, they recall Ezekiel's vision of the Lord abandoning the temple and Jerusalem to then stand on the mountain east of the city, which is the Mount of Olives. See that in Ezekiel 10, 18 through 19 and chapter 11 there, verses 22 through 23. And in Jesus' departure, the Lord had abandoned the temple in a literal and a symbolic sense. It was no longer God's house. Thus, it was left desolate and abandoned by God. It was now just the house of the Jews, filled with the corruptions that Jesus had just denounced, waiting on the doom that was coming upon them in their generation. And along the route to the Mount of Olives, his disciples, perhaps perplexed and disturbed at his outburst there at the temple, and seeking reassurance, they pointed out to him the magnificence of the temple, which was at the height of the city, incredibly beautiful and awe-inspiring. It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Yet Jesus did not reassure them by confirming the temple's beauty or its seeming indomitable permanence. Rather, he crushed that idea. Verse 2. You see all these, do you not? Truly, I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. And a bit later, up on the mountain, the disciples asked Jesus about his shocking statement. Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? And the question was really two questions. When and what? And Ken Gentry observes, by these when and what questions, they are asking about the time of the temple's destruction and the sign of his coming, which heralds the temple's end, which they wrongly associate with the end of the world. Like Jews of their time, the disciples, as John Calvin suggests, believed that the temple would stand till the end of time. And having this opinion deeply rooted in their minds, they did not suppose that while the building of the world stood, the temple could fall to ruins. So their question showed their confusion, equating the temple's destruction with the end of the present world order, the end of the world, and Jesus's, whom they knew was the Christ. The confession Peter made was in Matthew 16, 13 through 20. Jesus' second coming, his parousia bringing in the new world order. So they were confused, equating the temple's destruction with the end of the world and Jesus' second coming. Now this, Jesus clears up, and he answers their questions. And as he answers them, he clears up their confusion in how he does so. He first tells them when the temple will be destroyed. They first tell them when the temple will be destroyed. And he tells them of the nature of that destruction, including events leading up to it and giving a sign. And then he tells them that contrary to their expectations, his second coming at the end of history will not occur at that time. And second, that his second coming cannot be anticipated by looking for signs. And in verses 4 through 35, Jesus addresses this question of the disciples of when. He describes events leading up to and including the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. He sketches events of the apostolic age after his ascension in AD 33 through the Great Tribulation, to be followed by the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. When he, the glorified Christ, the Son of Man, comes in judgment, inaugurating the church age. And so when would these things be, as they ask? Well, in verses 32 through 35, Jesus gives a general time frame. In verse 34, right there, look at it. Verse 34, he proclaims, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until these things take place, which corresponds to the time frame that he had given in chapter 23, verse 36. And what are all these things? What are all these things? They are the events that Jesus, and we'll get to them, but they're the events that Jesus had been describing up to that point in the discourse. Jesus was saying that all of those events would take place before the current generation was gone. And so what does he mean by that? What does he mean by this generation? Well, the term used in Matthew and the other gospel means those living in Christ's day. Those living in the day that he was speaking of. We see this in Matthew 12, 38 to 39, 16, 4, 17, 17. It has the same meaning here. Also in the scriptures, a generation involves roughly 25 to 40 years. So the statement of Jesus here, it provided a concrete time frame for all that he said would happen up to that point in his discourse. So what events do all these things include? Well, in verses 4 through 14, Jesus announces various events that will take place from the time of his ascension until the destruction of the temple and the city, much of which took place during the time of the book of the Acts of the Apostles. And speaking to general events of temptations, sufferings, and tribulations in verses 4 through 8, Jesus calls them the beginnings of birth pangs. These sufferings are not signs that the end is nigh, but the beginnings of birth pains, which have occurred throughout history. Jesus uses biblical apocalyptic imagery here. He speaks to a period of suffering due to God's wrath. We see it in Isaiah 13:8, Jeremiah 6:24. We also see it in Romans 8:22. Which says, "For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now." And historical records further confirm that the occurrence of each of the portents that Jesus mentions in various, to various extents, basically, during that time. I mean, history proves that what he said was going to happen happened during that time. False prophets, wars, national conflicts, famines, and earthquakes. And these would be the background troubles in the world, framing the personal tribulations that they would be forced to endure. Thus, as Jesus warns us in verses 9 through 14, in the midst of these general events, there will be tribulations specific to the disciples who would be, by then would be apostles, and the church. And he lists them: delivered up, arrested, put to death, martyred, hated by the nations, persecuted. Also dealing with apostasy in the church, betrayal, false prophets, and many who would fall away as their love for Christ grew cold. See, for instance, there, Revelation 2:4. And their experience of many of these tribulations, their experiences are recorded in the book of Acts. We've been studying for the last couple of years. And some of them are mentioned in the epistles also. And history shows us persecution by the Jews and persecution by Rome. The Roman Empire provided regular tribulations for the church, causing much turmoil in the church. And Nero's persecutions, he was the first emperor there to persecute the Christians. His persecutions were particularly brutal. Indeed, he ordered Peter and Paul's death around AD 66 or 67. And by some accounts, six of the apostles were martyred prior to AD 70, and seven, if you include James, the brother of Jesus. It's also interesting to note the correspondence that these portents have with the first five seals of Revelation 6, 2 through 9. False Christ, wars, famine, death, including pestilence from Luke 21:11, and martyrdom. Yet despite general and personal temptations and tribulations, Jesus' call is to faithfully endure, given the promise of the ultimate spiritual security to those who persevere for as long as it takes. And resulting from such faithful perseverance of the apostles and the church, the gospel of Christ's kingdom would be proclaimed to the whole world. Verse 14. Consider for a second, though. Was the gospel actually proclaimed to the whole world before AD 70? And some would argue no, pointing to the Western Hemisphere as an example. However, in the way that the term "the whole world" is meant, similar to the term "the end of the earth" in Acts 1:8, well, the Bible's answer is yes, it had been. And the Apostle Paul unquestionably reports that the gospel had been proclaimed to the whole world. In Romans 10:18, written about AD 57, Paul affirms that the gospel had been proclaimed to all the earth and to the ends of the earth. And then in Colossians 1:6, writing from prison in Rome, around AD 62, in Acts 28, which actually we looked at last week, Paul speaks of the gospel which has come to you, as indeed in the whole world it is bearing fruit and increasing. The whole world. And then in verse 23, he speaks of the hope of the gospel that you heard, which has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, thus fulfilling Matthew 24:14, and also the Lord's task given to his apostles in Acts 1:8. The gospel had spread from Jerusalem to Judea and Samaria and to the whole world. Jesus then, in verses 15 through 18 here in Matthew 24, he reveals a sign that would be a signal to his followers that God's judgment upon Israel, the destruction of the city and the temple, was about to happen. It is the sign of the abomination of desolation. This sign would be something the Lord's people in Judea would surely recognize, so they could then react by fleeing, hopefully to escape the great tribulation. And this reference to the abomination of desolation in verse 15 harkens back to the prophecy of Daniel 9:7, 11:31, and 12:11. And many scholars think, and it seems likely, that the prophesied event in Daniel occurred in 167 B.C. with the profanation of the altar of burnt offering in the temple of Jerusalem by a representative of Antiochus IV Epiphanes. And you can read about that in 1 Maccabees 1:54 through 59 and 6:7. Now, if that is the correct historical fulfillment of the Daniel prophecy, Jesus is then saying that there will be another abomination of desolation, something the first atrocity foreshadowed, indeed far worse than that first atrocity. There are various suggestions that are out there as to what that particular event, that particular sign looked like. And it's best not to be dogmatic here about what event was the actual abomination of desolation. There are several reasonable ideas put out there by scholars. And Jesus doesn't spell it out. As it was, the Jewish wars raged from AD 67 to 70. And in June 69, Vespasian, he marched upon Jerusalem. He was the general armies there. He marched upon Jerusalem, taking his army up to the very walls of the city. But he did not stay long, as he had his eyes on a bigger prize. In July, the Roman army crowned him emperor, so he left Judea for the civil war against his rival, Emperor Vitellius. King versus king there. And in Luke's version of the discourse, 21:20, Jesus expressed a way to know how to identify the sign of God's judgment. That's what it says, Luke 21:20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. And so the Christians were probably alerted by Vespasian's armies to look for the abomination of desolation based on Jesus' words. Perhaps as the Roman armies pulled back for a short time, that was when those days were cut short for the sake of the elect, which is what Jesus says in verse 22. Jerusalem got a short reprieve, while Vespasian, he passed the armies on to his son Titus, those armies in Judea. But in April AD 70, Titus began his final march upon Jerusalem to eventually surround it, to cut off the city. And Josephus, who was a Jewish historian who was there, he's an eyewitness, he records all sorts of profanations that happened within the temple during that time, including criminals entering the Holy of Holies, murders within the temple, and other desecrations. And plainly, the temple was desolate. The Lord was gone, and what had been holy was desecrated by abominations, the abomination of desolation. So I recommend to you, I mentioned his name, Josephus. He has this book called The Wars of the Jews, chapters 4 through 7. Probably if you look for Josephus' books, you'd get his collected works, because that's pretty much how it comes these days. But he was a first century eyewitness. If you want to know what that looked like during that time, he was there. He will tell you about what happened up to the fall of Jerusalem and everything that happened during those times. It was horrific. And he records it. He tells what happened. There's also Eusebius. He wrote something called the Ecclesiastical History. He was a 4th century historian. He's called the father of church history because this is the first history of the church ever written. And in book 3, chapters 3 through 9, he talks about exactly what happened there. Exactly what happened there. He quotes Josephus a little bit, but he had access to some records that we don't have today. And now, possessing Jesus' warning, alerted by the Roman army's actions that the abomination was near, and then with the horrors that were going on inside the city and the temple, the alarm bell was ringing loudly for the Christians in Jerusalem. In the window of time before Titus' armies arrived, many of them wisely fled the city with urgency. And some of those who fled, they may have taken to the hills, as Jesus advised, and others, according to Eusebius, that 4th century historian I told you about, headed for one of the cities of Perea, which they called Pella. Whatever direction they fled, they made haste away from Jerusalem, which was Jesus' point. Flee! And from there, with Jerusalem sieged, totally surrounded by the Roman armies, things went from bad to worse. And Jesus describes it in chapter 24, verse 21. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now. No, and never will be. Now, Jesus here refers to what is known as the Great Tribulation. It took place in Jerusalem in the time of the siege before the city's destruction in AD 70. And Josephus, like I mentioned, he records the horrors in his book, The Jewish Wars, and they are truly horrifying, and I won't go into the details of all that today. But he records that during the siege, 1,100,000 Jews died. And across Judea, during the war, the deaths of tens of thousands of Jews occurred in Judea, and the enslavement of untold thousands more occurred, even the annihilation of whole cities and towns. And this had the Jews desperate. And so Jesus further warns that during these times, people would be desperate, looking for the Christ to save them. There would be rumors that he was here or there. And he says, don't believe it. Don't believe it. When people say that the Christ had come to save them from Romans, don't believe it. And if you remember, that's actually what the popularized idea of the Messiah, that they wanted to put on him, but he rejected that idea. He said no. So why not believe the rumors? What does he tell us? It's because the real Perugia, when the Christ, the Son of Man would return at the consummation of his kingdom would be an event that no one anywhere would miss. It would not be in secret. Verse 27, for as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. And Jesus here is referring to his second coming, using the word parousia. And there would be no mistaking his physical and final return. Thus, Jesus explicitly distinguished the parousia from the events of the siege of Jerusalem. And then he gives this enigmatic statement in verse 28. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. And there are a number of reasonable ideas as to what is meant by this. But perhaps R.T. France is right when he says, as the presence of the vultures infallibly indicates where the corpse is, so there will be no need to search for the coming of the Son of Man. It will be obvious. We'll have to break off there today and pick up next Sunday, Lord willing. But I hope at this point you're getting the thrust of Jesus' message. In the Olivet Discourse here in Matthew 24, Jesus was answering the questions of the disciples, correcting their misconceptions in his answers. And their question, which was really two questions, was asked based on Jesus' statement concerning the temple being destroyed. And Jesus answers in detail, answers the when concerning the things that would happen before the generation that was then living would pass away, including the temple's destruction. And the various events Jesus addressed that we've touched on today were not signs of Jesus' second coming, including the great tribulation of AD 70. Indeed, he is specific in verse 27 that when people are desperate for the conquering Christ to come and to save them from their tribulation and are drawn to various false Christs, to not be fooled. Jesus' physical return, bringing the consummation of his kingdom, the parousia, was not to be during that time. For when he returned at his second coming, it would be an unmistakable event for everyone. Unmistakable. And so when you see people pointing to various things that Jesus mentions here in his discourse, saying that they are signs of the second coming, know that they are wrong. They are wrong. Don't be confused by them. They have taken temporally dated events that happened long ago and mistakenly moved them to some future fulfillment. And like Gentry comments, Christians have embarrassed themselves for too long with calls for the end. Most of the verses they use for this purpose can be understood as referring to the destruction of the temple in AD 70. Let us not be confused, my friends. Beware of the self-proclaimed heralds of the end. When Jesus said certain events would happen before the generation that was alive at that time had before they had passed away, and that they were not signs, these things that he talked about were not signs of his second coming, his physical return, bringing the consummation of his kingdom, we must take him at his word. And because Christ Jesus prophesies truly, Christians must confidently take him at his word.